Side 5, Pearls of Lutra by Brian Jakes. Continuing on page 202. Ah, now, what would three slender young beauties like yourselves want with stodgy hazelnut puddin'? 'Twill only make fat beasts of you, missies. My old mother always used to say, if you're not fat, there's a slim chance some creature'll fall in love with you. So she did. And herself as thin as a beanpole, and greatly loved by all, so she was. Tansy pulled the pudding out of his reach. Tut, tut, Mr. Garrel. Your mother couldn't have loved you much, you great butter barrel. Ha, 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 ha. Skipper agreed with her, swiping a couple of blackberry muffins as he did so. That's right, missy. I don't know which is bigger, old Garrel's eyes or his belly. Ho, ho, ho. Ha! Look who's talking, old Famine Tummy himself, said Cracklin. Then she neatly caught one of the muffins as it was halfway to the otter's mouth and tossed it to Picknum. Garrel intercepted the muffin, and before Picknum could stop him, he had crammed half of it into his beak. True words, miss, true words. I'd sooner keep Skipper in victuals for a day than a season, so I would. Rollo strode busily up and tapped his paws on the wheelbarrow. No time for fooling about, friends. I have just made an important discovery. Follow me, and forget lunch. Before they could argue, he had ushered them off in the direction of the South Abbey wall. Garrel watched them go, dividing the hazelnut pudding in two with a spoon. To be sure, there's something heroic about a vole who won't let victuals keep him from his duty. That'll be voted abbot one day, Skip. You mark my words. Rollo the Righteous, they'll call him, so they will. Maidenhair spleenwort grew spider-like from the cracks in the stonework of the high south wall. Fronds of different lengths spread in all directions, each stem covered in tiny spearhead-shaped leaflets ranging from pale to bright green. Upward of a dozen or more plants clung to the sandstone, forming a tracery almost from ground to ramparts. "So sit o'er the maidenhair, gaze up north," Tansy said as she checked the poem parchment. Picknum and Cracklin were already racing away towards the wall steps. "Last one to the steps is a crawly old caterpillar." Rollo stared over the top of his glasses at Tansy. "I know I'm the crawly old caterpillar. But where are they going? Have I missed something?" Tansy took the old recorder's paw. "The only way we can carry out Firmall's instructions is to sit on the battlements of this wall over the maidenhair. Then we'll see what to make of this riddle." Come on, no hurry. We'll be crawly caterpillars together. 28. Day broke hot and hazy over the Isle of San Petra as the murderous game between Ublaz and Rasconza took a new turn. The fox was asleep in his cabin when a sharp rat-tat on the door awoke him. He sat up groggily, yawning and blinking. Quit that knockin' and come in. The door swung open to reveal the mad-eyed Pine Marten. Rasconza leapt for his sword, which lay on a nearby table. Ublaz held both paws wide to show he was unarmed. "Leave your blade, friend. I could have crept in here and slain you as you slept." Rasconza poured himself a beaker of seaweed grog, careful not to lock eyes with Ublaz. "So what gets you out of your bunk this early?" he snarled. The Emperor had dressed in brown silk that morning. He looked around at the stained benches and chairs, and chose to stand. "I merely call to tell you that the first new rudder and tiller are ready. My workers toiled through the night to finish them. Even as we speak, my creatures are fitting them to this vessel." Rasconza was nonplussed. He stood staring at his beaker. "Well, I'll say this for you, matey. You've got some nerve coming down here. Don't forget, I could order the crews to attack. We still outnumber your forces." Ublaz gestured elegantly towards the open door. "I took the precaution of arriving silently. Your sentries are asleep, and the other five crews snoring inside their cabins. A simple but effective operation, Rasconza. Oh, one other thing. Stay away from your sword. You would have to face me if you were intent on slaying me. Then our eyes would meet. And if I can put a poisonous water snake under my spell, a simple fox would present no problem. It's your move, friend. Rascanza could hear the trident rats hammering the rudder pins home and fitting the tiller above decks. Smiling, with a confidence he did not feel, the fox answered Ublas, "I still hold 5 of your creatures, the captains, remember? One shout from me, and they'll all be fish bait." The pine marten had painted his claws red to offset the brown silk. He breathed on them and buffed them on his flowing sleeve as he murmured, "Shout away, fox, shout away. Do you think I gave you valuable fighters to captain these ships? Like Orlug, whom you slew. Those 5 are worthless fools. Kill them if you want to." Rascanza scratched his matted tail with grimy claws, baffled. "Well, what do you want? You've got me cornered in here. You don't care about your own creatures, and now you're fixing me ship up with a new rudder and tiller. You've probably got a gang of your best lizards waiting outside to slay me. Is that what you want?" Ublas leaned back against the cabin door, smiling. "I've already said I don't want to slay you, Rascanza. Friendship and trust, that's what I want. Look, here's what I propose. Forget the rats I appointed as captains. Choose your own from among the crews, and I'll give the order for mine to stand down. Then I want you to pick out all those loyal to you and crew this ship up. If we are to rule San Petra together, you must prove yourself to me, Rascanza. I want you to captain this vessel, sail anywhere you please, but bring me back the finest cargo of plunder ever seen on a corsair ship. Prove you are my captain in chief." Rascanza's eyes lit up. "You mean that? Fair enough, Ublas. I'll pick me crew and bring back plunder to this isle that'll make your eyes pop out." The emperor grinned wryly. "Oh, I don't think I'd like that to happen. But I'm glad you see things my way. You are a worthy partner, Rascanza. I like having clever beasts around me. There are too many fools in this world." When Ublas had departed, Rascanza called the crews together and gave them a highly falsified version of what had taken place between himself and the emperor, giving them the impression that he had outsmarted Mad-Eyes. The wave vermin cheered wildly and began to break open kegs of grog. Then the fox banged his sword hilt on the jetty for silence and continued his narrative. "So I says to old Mad-Eyes, 'Get those rats of yourn off our ships. I won't have no beasts commanding these vessels, but our own.' So, Baltur, Guncho, and you, Grewjaw, the stoat, and you, Deadgut, the ferret, and you, Buckler, the sea rat, you're my 5 new captains now. Stand up lively, the rest of you. I'm taking my ship Blood Keel on a plundering trip, and I wants none but the best alongside of me." Amid scenes of wild reveling on the sunlit jetty, Rascanza chose his crew for the voyage. They leapt aboard Bloodkeel, yelling and roaring in anticipation of plunder and slaughter. Guja, the former steers rat of Baranka's ship Freebooter, was made steers rat of Bloodkeel, because there was none better for the job. The vermin laughed and cheered as he twiddled a tune on his melodeon, singing in a cracked baritone, "Would your plunder from your mother? Yes, I would, yes, I would. For me mother always said I was no good. I'm a steers rat bred and born, and I'm sailing in the morn. Stand aside, me lucky buckos, let me go. Cut me teeth upon a cutlass, yes I did, yes I did, and me poor old daddy ran away and hid, saying, 'That's no child of mine, let him sail across the brine. Stand aside now for the vermin, let him go. If there's plunder in the offing, that's for me, that's for me. And I never charge I'll kill you all for free. Give me lots of lovely loot, and a cask of grog ter boot. Up the anchor, loose the sails, and let me go.'" Sinking majestically into the western horizon, the sun burned skies of blue and gold to a crimson hue. Ublas and Sagatar watched from an upper window as the hot day drew to a close. Bloodkeel was a mere speck far out to the southeast. The emperor poured 2 goblets of rich dark wine and pushed 1 in the direction of his chief trident rat. "Now you may ask me," he said.
"Ask you what, sire?" replied Sagatar apprehensively.
The pine marten sipped his wine, still watching Bloodkeel diminishing into the hazy distance of the ocean. "What is on your mind?" he said.
Why did I repair the fox's ship? Why did I let him sail off with a crew of his own choosing? Why did I not crush the wave vermin this morning when I had the chance? These are the questions on your mind. Am I correct? Nervously, Sagittar swallowed the wine in one gulp. Mightiness, you have read my mind. Ublaz refilled the goblets, narrowing his eyes to keep Bloodkeel in his vision. You are only thinking what every other beast on San Petra is thinking at this moment, so I will tell you. Rasconza is a born troublemaker, ambitious and deceitful. Like Barranca, he is popular with the Corsair crews. This would make him dangerous in the long run, so I decided to dispense with him. First I let him choose a crew, knowing he would choose his closest allies. You see, there may be those among them who would also be future trouble to me, so I dispense with them also. But I do not want the other crews to know I am responsible for the slaying of Rasconza and his friends. I want them to think that their emperor is benevolent to them. If they consider me their friend, I will have their loyalty. So there you have your answer. Sagittar paused, the goblet half lifted to her lips. But, sire, you have not slain Rasconza and his crew. They have sailed away alive, free to return to San Petra when they will. Ublaz smiled, shaking his head at the trident rat's simplicity. Look out to sea, Sagittar. If you can still see Rasconza's ship, then take a last look at it. Bloodkeel has only one place to go. Straight down. When my workers fitted the new tiller and rudder this morning, they were carrying out my instructions. Below the waterline, they hewed the stern until the wood was thin, then they fitted the rudder. It has a special metal spike protruding from the back of it. Every time the steer's rat moves the tiller, that spike gouges into the thin stern below the waterline. By morning, Bloodkeel will be where I have sent her with all aboard, deep down on the ocean bed. The goblet smashed upon the floor as it fell from Sagittar's nerveless paws. She stared with speechless horror at the smiling pine marten. Ublaz spread his paws wide. Now I have no enemies, and I own the Corsair fleet. No beast in all the seas and oceans is more powerful and wise than I. The mad-eyed emperor had emerged as victor in his murderous game against the wave vermin. However, he had reckoned without the chain of events he had set off by slaying Lutra and his kin for 6 rose-tinted pearls. 29. On Mossflower Shore, dawn arrived, bright and warm. Logalog and his Glossom Shrews had been busy most of the night, working on Grath's longboat, to make it seaworthy again. The big otter viewed their work admiringly, pacing up and down as she inspected her new craft. The shrew chieftain pointed out the features his workers had accomplished. We used 8 long willow boughs, still green. See, we've made a double outrigger of your little boat by fitting a shrew logboat to each side of her. My shrews put a longer keel on your boat, too. You'll need it on the high seas. She's a good un now, matey. Grath had to agree. The new craft was ideal for seafaring. It rowed in the stream with a logboat fixed to either side by the willow boughs, leaving enough space between the outriggers to enable it to be paddled by oars. Shrews were wading into the stream, stocking the logboats with provisions, which left more passenger space on the main vessel. Clucky joined them, a bowl of soup in one paw, a slice of oatcake in the other, and a large seaweed poultice bound to the bump he had received between his ears. Spiffin idea, what? I've always fancied myself as a jolly old nautical type, you know. I say, do you think we'll have enough grub along for the voyage? A chap could starve out there without plenty of fodder. I'll be captain, of course, natural heir of command and all that. Born to lead, my old pater always used to say, what? Martin placed a bowl of soup in front of the captive sea rat and sat down next to him. Here, that'll take the edge off your hunger, he said. Now, what's your name? The rat grabbed the bowl gratefully. They calls me Blade Rib, sir. The warrior mouse tore off a hunk of shrew bread and gave it to the rat. No need to sir me, Blade Rib. Where do you think the ship has gone? Lifting his lips from the bowl, Blade Rib nodded seaward. Due west for San Petra. I'd take me oath on it. Martin stared levelly at him. "Then your oath better be good, because you're coming with us. How far away is this place you call Sempetra? Some say 'tis beyond where the sun sinks in the west. Too far for your little boat to sail, I'd say." Martin eyed the distant horizon as he strapped the sword to his back. "You let me worry about that. Now, tell me all you know about Sempetra." By late morning, they were ready to sail. Logalog and the Gwasim crowded around the bank, as Martin, Grath, and Klecki waded into the shallows, leading Blade Rib by a rope tied about his middle. Viola Bankbull followed them, crying, "I'm going with you to help free Abbot Doro." Martin had noted a change in Viola. She seemed more sensible and confident since her captivity. Several times that morning she had requested to sail with them. Now, as before, Martin gave her his answer. "Sorry, little one. It would be far too dangerous for you. We'll bring the abbot back, I promise you. Go back to Redwall now. There's a good creature. Logalog and his shrews will see you get home safe." Water splashed as Viola stamped her footpaw in the shallows. "Just because I'm not a grown-up, you don't want me. It's not fair. I'm being treated like a silly little dibbon." She turned and flounced off across the shore towards the woodlands. "Viola, we don't think you're a dibbon," Martin called after her. "All of us know that you're a very brave young bank vole, but you're not old enough yet to find your way through the woods alone. Wait for Logalog to take you home." Pause akimbo, Viola turned and glared at Martin. "I know my own way back to the abbey, thank you. I don't need a whole tribe of shrews to hold my paw. Goodbye." With her apron string streaming out in the breeze, she strode resolutely off. Logalog turned to Martin. "She's a bold creature, sure enough. But you're right, Martin. She's far too young to be traveling on her own. Jesset and Tenno, follow the little maid and see her safely back to Redwall. Talking of which, I'm not letting you go without extra help, matey. There's Two Ear, who'd be proud to sail with you. Plog, Welko." Two stout shrews leapt forward and joined the party in the shallows. Grath Longfletch looked them over approvingly, saying, "Are you sure you can spare two strong beasts like these, Logalog?" Throwing a paw fondly about the shoulders of the two, Logalog nodded at his otter friend. "These are my two sons. They can eat, fight, sail, and sing like no other shrews I know of. They've pestered me half the night to let them sail with you. Ha-har! Anything to avoid the iron-pawed discipline of their father. Ain't that right, buckos?" Plog nudged his father's ribs playfully. "I'll bring you back a nice walking stick, old feller." He ducked a hefty swipe from his parent, who was grinning proudly. "Get out of it, you tadpole. Bring me back any walking sticks, and I'll break 'em o'er your tail. Take care of each other and our friends, you two, and always remember you're the sons of a Gwasim chieftain. Don't do nothing I wouldn't do, you blood puddins." Welko stamped back ashore, his face serious. "I ain't going on no ship that don't have a name." Logalog folded both paws across his fat stomach. "You're right, Welko. Ahoy, Grath! That's why your vessel's had so much bad luck, matey. She ain't got a name. What are you going to call her? Dabby, bring some markin' dye to paint a name on." The big otter scratched her scarred head. "Hmm, a name? I've never given it much thought. Free beast." They all turned to look at Martin. He pointed at the vessel and said, "We're all free beasts, and we're on a mission to free a good old beast, the Abbot of Redwall. So let her name be Free Beast." As the tide began to swell, a short ceremony was carried out in the mouth of the river. Every creature present was issued with a beaker of shrew beer. Logalog was lifted aboard the craft bearing two beakers, one in each paw. Standing in the prow, he recited a Gwasim boat-naming poem. "Whether she sails on river or sea, may the wind be always behind her. May she always be welcomed by friends like me. May the foe beast never find her. Let her crew hold the lives of each other dear, and avoid every sharp rock or reef. Good seasons and fates, now listen and hear. Keep this gallant free beast from all grief." Amid rousing cheers, Logalog poured one beaker over the prow and drank the other in a single swallow, along with everyone else. Martin and his friends tossed their weapons aboard and hauled themselves over the side. Grath took the tiller as Plog and Welko hoisted the sail upon its new ashpole mast. Martin and Klecky stood forward, punting deep either side with the oars. Freebeast skimmed out of the river and into the open sea, her sail billowing bravely as she caught the wind and bucked head-on into the first rollers. Klecky shipped his oar, as Martin did. Standing upright, the five crew members of Freebeast held their weapons aloft and roared their war cries across the sun-flecked waters to the Gwasim on the shore.
"Red Wall! Eulalia! Holt Lutra! Logga 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 log!"
Seabirds wheeled overhead in the bright summer day. Framed against the cloudless blue above, the sun beat down on the strange three-hulled vessel as it plowed the waves, on into the unknown deeps of the wild ocean, questing for Duro, the Father Abbot of Redwall Abbey. The voyage had begun. 30. Sitting on the south wall top alongside her friends, Tansy looked upward to the north.
"Well, what do you see?" she said to Rollo.
Gazing in the same direction, the old recorder answered,
"I see the south face of the Abbey building, as you do. Any beasts see anything different?"
Picknum and Cracklin began giggling, a sure sign that they were onto something. Rollo glared sternly over the top of his glasses at the Abbey maids.
"Well, I'm glad some creatures find the situation amusing. No doubt you are about to tell us something, when you are quite finished with your fit of the giggles."
Struggling to regain control of themselves, the pair responded,
"Tee-hee-hee, hrumph. Don't you think we should be paying more attention to the next words of the poem, sir? Tee-hee. Cracklin says we look like poor fledglings waiting to be fed. Hee-hee-hee. Sitting on top of a wall with our heads up."
Tansy stifled a smile at the thought. Rollo unrolled the thin parchment rather huffily, spreading it on the wall top.
"Ahem! Just as I was about to do," he said. "Now, let me see. Put a home with our Abbey warrior, north, east, south, at the start. Then, to complete this riddle, add the last thing in my heart."
Nodding to each other, Picknum and Cracklin gave the answer.
"Another name for a home?
A house.
Who is our Abbey warrior?
Martin.
Who put them together and named me a little bird?
House Martin."
Tansy was about to speak when Rollo jumped in ahead of her. "North, east, south begin with N-E-S. The last thing in my heart is the letter T. Put them together and we have nest.
We're looking for a house martin's nest."
Not to be outdone, Tansy swiftly added her contribution. "Below the mouth of a mouse looking south, all in a deserted dwelling. So sit o'er the maidenhair, gaze up north, and solve what my next words are telling.
Look, a small attic window, and see carved in the stone above it? I'll wager that's the head of a mouse. See?"
Four pairs of eyes peered keenly up at the highest window on the north side of the abbey. Sure enough, the arched apex of the stone was decorated with a carved head. Rollo polished his spectacles hard, blinking, and said, "Yes, it is a creature of some sort, but it's too high up to tell what it is. The only way to be sure is to go up there."
Tansy tugged at the old recorder's sleeve to gain his attention. She pointed to the spot where Picknum and Cracklin had been sitting a moment before.
"They've already gone. Come on, old friend, let's follow."
She assisted the old bank vole down the wall steps.
"I wonder what the last one up there is this time," he muttered, shaking his head. "A tottering tadpole or a boggled beetle?"
The hedgehog maid smiled as they crossed the lawn.
"I'd better not tell you, or you'd have Mother Alma send him to bed with no supper."
The high window in question was the one in Fermal's attic. It was filled by a large chunk of translucent rock crystal. Tansy reached it by standing on the back of Fermal's armchair. Cracklin climbed up to help her, whilst Rollo and Picknum held on to the battered old chair, steadying it. The hedgehog maid gave a cry of delight as she felt the lump of crystal move beneath her paw.
"Ha-ha! It's not even cemented in. Mind your paws, Cracklin. Look out below!"
She pulled it loose. The crystal sent up a cloud of dust as it thudded onto the cushioned armchair seat. Cracklin crawled into the window space and poked her head out to look around. Picknum danced up and down with impatience. Can you see the house martin's nest? Is the pearl there?
Only when Tansy and the squirrel maid were safe back on the attic floor did Cracklin make her report.
Phew! I felt awfully dizzy looking out of the window. Do you realize how high up we are? But I could see the nest. It's on a narrow stone parapet wedged in a corner.
Rollo was obviously trying to keep calm as he asked the vital question.
Did you see the, pearl?
Cracklin perched on the chair arm, looking at her friend's expectant faces, framed in the sunlit shaft from the window.
I saw the nest, a typical house martin dwelling, almost like a round ball with a small hole for an entrance. But I don't think any birds have used it for some seasons. It looked empty.
Tansy nodded thoughtfully.
Exactly as the rhyme says. Below the mouth of a mouse looking south, all in a deserted dwelling. The nest is the deserted dwelling. But the thing that really mystifies me is how did a very old squirrel like Firmald manage to get the pearl into the nest?
Picknum clapped a paw to her mouth, but could not stop the giggle that bubbled forth.
Tee-hee-hee! Ask Mr. Rollo. He's pretty ancient. Hee-hee! He should know!
Quite unexpectedly, the old recorder smiled and made a slight bow to the mouse maid.
Thank you, Picknum. Nice to see you showing some respect for your elders. As a matter of fact, the question has been puzzling me. However, I think I know how Firmald managed to place the pearl in that house martin's nest.
It was the three Abbey maids' turn to look surprised.
Rollo seated himself in the armchair and explained in three words, Firmald's fishing rod.
Tansy clapped her paws in delight. Of course, I'll go and get it.
Cracklin lay in the window space leaning outward, while Tansy and Picknum held tight to her foot paws as she fished for the nest. It was a lot simpler than they thought. With a triple barbed hook attached to the line, the nest was easily snagged. Cracklin reeled it up carefully as Rollo paced the floor, chatting away to himself, highly pleased with his own wisdom.
Quite basic, really. Firmald hooked the nest, reeled it up here, placed the pearl in it, and lowered it back into position again. Ha! You can't beat an old head on old shoulders.
Cracklin swung the nest inside, and Tansy caught it skillfully.
Seasons ago, a clever little house martin had formed the circular structure of grass, leaves, and mud, leaving a round opening. She had probably used it several times to rear her egg chicks.
Rollo grinned broadly at the three eager faces as he upended the nest and shook it.
Just as the rhyme says, my fourth tear I shed for the Abbey red wall, laid where it never should hatch or fall. Behold, here is our fourth pearl, young maids.
But only an acorn shell fell out onto the attic floorboards. In complete silence, Tansy took the nest from Rollo. The hedgehog maid rummaged inside it with her paw, then she shook it and held it up to the light, her face a picture of disappointment.
There's no pearl. It's gone.
Picknum and Cracklin were both shocked. They too inspected the empty nest, but no amount of looking could conjure up a pearl that was not there. All four friends slumped on the attic floor, totally dejected. Tansy picked up the acorn shell and looked closely at it.
This is an empty shell. It's been cracked and stuck together again. See?
She split the shell and drew forth the scrap of parchment which had been rolled up inside.
Here's the clue to our fifth pearl.
Though I don't intend opening or reading it until we find the fourth pearl. Agreed?
Rollo spoke for himself and the other two maids.
Agreed. It would not seem right. We must discover each pearl in the order that Firmald intended us to. Come on, cheer up, friends. Let's go to the grounds below and try to find that pearl.
Alma sat with Garrel and Skipper at the table in Great Hall. Late evening sunlight streamed through the stained glass windows onto a table that did full justice to the culinary skills of Redwall cooks. Neither beast had let injury blunt his appetite. With no great interest in the elderberry tart or the small beaker of plum cordial before her, the badger mother turned to Skipper, saying,
No news of Martin and Clecky yet?
The brawny otter looked up from his summer salad, took a draught of October ale, and wiped his mouth on the back of a paw.
I'm afraid not, Marm, though I expect the otter patrol I sent out to be back with some information before dawn tomorrow. Who knows? Mayhap they'll bring Martin and Clecky with them. The abbot and Viola, too, with any luck. Alma sniffed hard, blinked back a tear, and sighed. Poor Dural and Viola. I hope they're not still in the clutches of that foul lizard thing and those scurvy sea rats.
Geralt demolished a wedge of celery and mushroom turnover with all the ease of a seasoned trencher beast.
Ah, now, don't be worrying yourself over things you can't control, Marm. Sure, as me old mother always used to say, 10 seasons from now you'll be wondering what you were bothered about today, if you're still around to bother. Will you look at old Rollo, and those young maids over there? They've got faces on them like frazzled frogs, so they have. Hi there, Tansy. Bring your friends over here and join the Redwall Warriors.
When the four friends had joined Alma, Skipper, and Geralt, the owl applied himself back to a chunk of heavy fruitcake.
There now, aren't we the grand old miserable table-mates? What are you lot looking so down in the whiskers about?
Tansy explained in detail about the house martin's nest. Geralt listened carefully as he helped himself to Alma's tart.
Hmm, so there was no pearl in the nest, eh? Well, what do you suppose happened? Did it fall out? Have you searched the grounds below the nest?
Rollo picked at a slice of apple pie.
Oh, yes, we went over the area with a fine-tooth comb. There was no sign of anything resembling a pearl.
Geralt picked crumbs from his chest as he talked.
So where in the name of fate do you think the pearl went?
Rollo pushed away his apple pie and shrugged.
How should I know?
The owl blinked his enormous eyes.
Cha! Me old mother wouldn't be too pleased with you, Rollo. A beast of your long seasons and wisdom not being able to see what's staring you in the whiskers? If the pearl never fell, then sure it was taken by some beast or other. That's clear enough.
The recorder of Redwall Abbey stared indignantly at Geralt.
Oh, indeed? Some beast took it, eh? From over halfway up the abbey wall and a nest on a tiny ledge? Pray be good enough to tell me, sir, what sort of creature was it?
Geralt finished his crumb-picking ablutions and hopped down to the floor, chuckling at the angry recorder.
Ah, sure, you're getting your whiskers and a tiz over nothing at all. I hate leaving a lovely table of victuals like this. But if you'll be kind enough to follow me good self, I'll try to help you.
The four friends followed Geralt up to Fermal's attic. He waddled around the abandoned martin's nest, touching it now and again with a hefty talon as he inquired,
"And this is exactly as you found it, just like it is now?"
"Just as we found it," Tansy answered.
Geralt looked from one to the other.
"And, of course, you all had your eyes shut tight, did you not?"
Picknam was running out of patience.
"Silly owl, we had our eyes wide open," she said, stamping her paw down.
From amid the dry grass and mud of the nest, Geralt picked a small grayish-black feather.
"So you had your eyes open and never saw this, huh? The old mother would have given yez the length of her beak, so she would."
Tansy twirled the feather in her paw, mystified.
"What is it, Geralt?"
The owl hopped up onto the armchair and blinked at Tansy.
"Faith, don't you know, missy? 'Tis the neck feather of a jackdaw, the greatest robber ever to have an old set of wings. Your pearl was stolen by a jackdaw. They'll have anything shiny, the thieving blackguards. They'd have the eyes out of your head if you weren't watching them,"
so my mother used to say. Rollo plopped into the armchair glumly.
"You mean to tell us that the fourth pearl was stolen by a jackdaw? It could be anywhere in Mossflower, or even beyond by now. How are we ever going to find it?"
Geralt leapt to the floor and started waddling off back to the remains of dinner in Great Hall.
"Easy. I'll show you after breakfast tomorrow," he said.
Wolger, the otter gatekeeper, poked his head round the door of Great Hall and called to Alma.
"Visitors to see your marm? You too, Skip."
Led by Logalog and half a score of burly otters, the Gwossam Shrews piled into the hall. Despite his still-healing wounds, Skipper dashed to meet them.
"Ahoy! Rangapaw! You timed that nicely. Dinner ain't over yet. Logalog, you old son of a shrew, how are you, matey?"
Greetings were exchanged as helpers ran to put out extra food for the newcomers. Logalog and Rangapaw joined Alma and the otter chieftain at the big table. Skipper poured October ale for them, giving them a moment to slake their thirst. Rangapaw was a large, sleek otter. She stood almost a head taller than Skipper, her father. Mopping off a tankard of ale, she gave Skipper a friendly buffet across the back, which nearly knocked him from his seat.
He winked fondly at her. "Now then, you great water hound, stop knocking your old daddy about and make your report." The big otter poured herself more October ale. "Well, we traveled as fast as we could when word came from Logalog that it was our mates, the Redwallers, in trouble. But we arrived too late. Old Logalog can tell you the rest. We met him on the shore."
The Gwasim chieftain went on to explain how Lask Frildur and Romska had sailed off with the abbot and how Martin had taken up pursuit of them with his small band. He told of Grath Longfletch rescuing Viola, then looked about, saying, "Is the Vole Maid not back yet? She should have arrived more'n a day ago." Alma looked shocked. "Back here? No. Surely Martin didn't let the little maid travel alone." Logalog shook his head. "Of course not, Marm. She had an escort of two stout shrews. Hey, Jesset and Tenno, what say you?" Jesset and Tenno stood forward. "We saw her right to the gates, Marm. She thanked us politely, but insisted on going in by herself." Rangipa quaffed her second tankard of ale and stood up. "Pack some of those victuals for me and the crew. We'll go straight away and search for the little maid." When the otters had departed, Logalog patted Alma's paw reassuringly. "Ahoy, now, don't fret yourself, Marm. They'll find her. And Martin and his crew won't rest until they bring your abbot back home. I know it, and you would, too, if you'd seen the iron in his eyes when he set sail after those waves come. Ha! That's one warrior they won't shake off. I'd take me affidavit on that." "That may be so," said Rollo. "But we must not slow down our search for the pearls. If we find the ransom, we may be able to save some bloodshed." A moment later, Sister Cicely stormed in and banged the table with a medicine spoon. "I'll wager no beast has seen those three dibbins. They're not in the dormitory. I've searched all around the abbey." Tansy interrupted the irate sister. "Do you mean Arvin, Diggum, and Gerbol?" Cicely brandished the medicine spoon fiercely. "Who else? Ooh, just let me get my paws on that little wretch Arvin. He's the ringleader. The other two babes would follow him anywhere. I'll dose him purple with nettle soup when I get him. I'll bath him until his ears are bright red. I'll... Alma interrupted the sister sternly. "You'll leave them to me, Cicely. After all, they're only dibbins. No doubt they'll be hiding somewhere, like last time. I say, let us wait until they get hungry enough to come out. Then we'll see what they have to say for themselves." At that moment the three dibbins in question were wandering deep in Mossflower Wood. Wolger had left the abbey main gate ajar when he admitted the otters and Gwasim shrews, and the three abbey babes had seized their chance. Armed with sticks and a blanket, which they intended to make into a tent, they set off. They also had a big fruit cake, a bag of candied chestnuts, and a flask of strawberry cordial, purloined from the kitchens. Arvin smiled to himself as he muttered to his willing companions, "This a time we get lots of monkey and dusted, catch her some of those blizzards and smack 'em with our big sticks. Then they be gladder to see us, I bet yer." Diggum waved her stick about savagely. "Us'ns be awful turrible haminals." Gerbol agreed wholeheartedly. "Yer, and us'ns won't might come back till we be growed up. We 'em shouted 'em all and pur 'em to bed early." The soft folds of velvet summer night descended over the woodlands, silencing birdsong as the three tiny figures were swallowed up in still warm darkness. 31. Dawn broke hot and warm over a sheltered inlet on the northwest coast of San Petra. The ebbing tide had thrown up some flotsam from the vessel Bloodkeel. Still intact, the rudder and tiller lay among the shells and seaweed festooning the tideline. Lashed to it by heaving line were Resconza the fox and his steer's rat Guja. Pounded and battered by the seas, they coughed up salt water as they extricated themselves from the ropes, tiller, and rudder that had kept them alive for almost 2 days on the ocean. The pair dragged themselves painfully over the shore into the shadow of a rock overhang at the foot of a hill. There they found fresh water. Greedily the two corsairs lapped at the tiny rivulet of cold, crystal-clear liquid that threaded thinly and dripped from the mossy underside of their shelter. Rasconza picked salt rime from his eye corners, gazing beyond the cove,
out to where the deep ocean glimmered and shimmered in early morn. The fox's voice was rasping and painful, bitter and vengeful.
"A full crew, matey, and we're the only two left alive to tell the tale."
Guja had scraped some of the damp moss off with his dagger. He chewed it until there was no more moisture or nourishment left, then spat it out viciously.
"Aye, Cap'n, all our shipmates either drowned or eaten by the big fishes, every beast jack of them, slain by Mad-Eye's treachery."
Rascanza unbuckled the saturated belt that held his daggers and laid the weapons out one by one on the grass. Selecting his favorite blade, he began honing it on a piece of rock.
"Mark my words, Guja. The worst day's work Ublaz ever did was to leave me alive. Though he don't know it, his dying day is near."
As Chief Trident Rat, it was Sagatar's duty to report to her emperor morning and night. As she entered the Pine Marten's throne room, Sagatar could see that Ublaz was in a foul mood. He slumped on his throne, staring at the lifeless form of Grawl, his messenger gull. The great black-backed bird had died of exhaustion, bringing news back to its master. Ublaz touched the limp wing feathers contemptuously with his footpaw.
"Ha! Grawl was the only one of my gulls to make it back. And now look at him. Useless bundle of bird flesh."
In the silence that followed, Sagatar shuffled nervously. Feeling it her duty to make some comment, she inquired meekly,
"Did the bird bring good news of your pearls, sire?"
Ublaz rose, and stepping over the dead gull, he stared out of the wide chamber window at the ocean beyond.
"Lask Frildur and Romska are sailing back to Sempetra. They didn't get the pearls. Instead, they're bringing the Father Abbot of Redwall Abbey as a hostage. The tears of all oceans are to be his ransom. What do you think of that?"
Sagittar's voice was apprehensive as she answered,
"Well, at least you have something to bargain with, sire."
Ublaz whirled upon her, his eyes blazing angrily.
"Bargain? I am Ublaz, Emperor of Seas and Oceans. I take. Twice my creatures have failed me. Twice! If I had gone after the pearls myself in the first place, I would have them now, set in my new crown. There will be no more bargaining or playing of games. When that ship drops anchor here, we will sail again back to the land of Mossflower and Redwall Abbey. All of my ships and every creature on this island. That way there will be none left behind to seize power and plot behind my back. I will lead every beast, monitors, trident rats, and corsairs, against Redwall. I will smash it stone from stone and rip those pearls from the wreckage. The ruins of that abbey will remain as a marker to the dead beasts that lie beneath them. The ones who tried to defy the might of Ublaz."
Romska ushered Abbot Durrell into her cabin. With a few swift slashes of her sword, she released him from his rope shackles. The corsair ferret sat Durrell upon her bunk, issuing him with a beaker of seaweed grog and some hard ship's biscuit. The old mouse sipped at the fiery liquid, squinting without his glasses, as he stared curiously at Romska.
"Why are you helping me like this, my child?"
Romska sheathed her cutlass blade firmly.
"I ain't your child, I keep telling you, and I ain't doing this to help you. 'Tis more for my benefit you be kept alive. We're sailing into bad cold weather. You wouldn't last a day out on deck. Sit tight in here and keep the door locked. Do you hear?"
Abbot Durrell smiled warmly at the wild-looking corsair.
"You are a good creature, Romska. What a pity you chose the life of a corsair."
Romska stood with one paw on the door latch.
"It ain't none of your business what I chose to be," she said harshly. "'Tis a long, hard story how I come to be what I am. Anyhow, I likes being a corsair, and I ain't ashamed of my life. Now you stay put, old Durrell, and don't open this door to none but me. I don't trust that Lask Frildur no more. He's got a crazy look in his eyes of late."
Slamming the cabin door, Romska went aft. The weather was cold and the seas a slate gray. She faced forward and peered anxiously. The wind was dropping, a deep fog bank was looming up, and ice was beginning to form on the rigging. Turning, she looked aft, scanning the waters in the ship's wake. Somewhere out along the eastern horizon, Romska thought she saw a small dark dot. She blinked and looked again. But she had lost the location of the dot owing to the ship's movement on the oily, waveless swell. A slithering sound behind Romska caused her to turn swiftly, paw on sword hilt. Lask Frildor was standing there watching her. Though he looked cold and seasick, there was a crafty glimmer in the Monitor General's eyes.
"Where have you hidden the Abbot Mouse, Romska?" he hissed.
Romska drew her cutlass and circled until the lizard was back to the stern rail. She pointed the blade at him.
"Never you mind about the Abbot. I'm taking charge of him. Keep your distance, Lask, or I swear I'll spit you on this blade."
Lask flicked his tongue at the Corsair Ferret.
"Lzt! Food is running low. Weather is growing colder. You have got us lost again."
Romska stared contemptuously at the Monitor.
"Vittles is as short for me and my crew as they are for you and your lizards. As for the weather, well, it'll get colder afore we're out of these waters, and if you think I've got you lost, then you're welcome to navigate for yourself. Other than that, you stay out of my way, and don't start any trouble that you can't finish."
Lask stayed leaning on the rail, shivering, but still smiling slyly.
"When I start trouble, Romska, you will be the first to know."
The longboat, with the outriggers on either side of it, bobbed and swayed as Welko the Shrew slid down from the masthead. Grath helped him to the narrow deck. "Well, was it the Corsair ship you saw to the west?" she asked. Welko drew his cloak against the cold.
"I'm not sure. I thought I saw a sail, then I lost sight of it. There could be fog ahead. Mayhap she's sailed into it."
Plecky was seated aft, guarding a small cooking fire he had made on a bed of sand, surrounded by slate. The lanky hair had taken to be very nautical.
"Ahoy there, me hearty chaps. Grub. Vittles. Are about ready,"
he called out to everyone.
"I say, Plug, old cove, nip over into the larboard shrew boat and dig out a few apples, will you? There's a good old barnacle, what?"
The two shrew boats that served as outriggers to the logboat were loaded with supplies. Martin had made space in the starboard one for Blade Rib, their sea rat captive. The sea rat stared sullenly at Plog as the latter climbed across to the far logboat. The shrew rummaged through the ration packs before calling back to Clucky.
"There's not many apples left."
Graf glared across at Blade Rib.
"Have you been sneaking across at night and stealing apples?"
Martin patted Graf's broad back.
"No, he's been right there all along. I've kept my eye on him. Clecky, you haven't been pinching the odd half-dozen apples, have you?"
The hare's ears stood up with indignation.
"Do you mind belaying that statement, old sea mouse? I haven't touched a single apple." "Humph! Valley cheek of some crew beasts. Take a proper look over there. I'm sure you'll find heaps of jolly old apples rolling about somewheres, what?"
Plog began turning the packs over and checking them. Suddenly he gave a shout of alarm as he rolled back a crumpled canvas cover. Drawing his sword, Martin leapt aboard the logboat, only to find Plog wrestling with a kicking, screaming Viola Bankbowl. Martin caught her sharply by the ear.
"What in the name of thunder are you doing here, miss? I told you to go back to the Abbey. You could have been drowned, or injured, or—"
"How did you manage to stow away on this logboat, and what happened to Jessic and Tenno?" Viola wriggled free of the warrior's grasp and kicked nimbly over to the longboat, where she hid behind Clecky, shouting,
"I gave them the slip and doubled back and stole aboard while you were all drinking and naming the boat. I wasn't drowned or injured, see? Told you I was going to help rescue Father Abbot, didn't I? Well, what are you going to do now? You can't turn back or throw me overboard."
Grath Longfletch grinned and winked at the bull maid.
"You're right there, young'un. My, you're a peppery one, and no mistake. Looks like we're stuck with you."
Clecky looked over his shoulder, viewing the stowaway sternly.
"You're lucky we aren't sea rats, or those corsair bods, Miguel, or we'd have chucked you overboard to the fishes just to save feeding you, what?"
Martin shook his head in despair as he gazed at the defiant volmaid.
"Think of the distress you've caused Mother Alma and all your friends back at the Abbey. They probably think you're still a prisoner aboard that ship with the Abbot. If you'd gone back to Redwall, as I told you,
It would have saved a load of worry for every beast who cares what happens to you, miss. The sudden realization of what she had done caused tears to flood down Viola's cheeks, and she hung her head in shame. Martin could not bear to see a young creature so unhappy. He patted the vole maid's head gently.
There, there, now, don't cry. Your motives were good, and I know you were only trying to help. Welcome aboard, Viola. Come on, smile, and we'll try to make the best of it.
They dined on toasted cheese and hot shrewbread, half an apple apiece, and some oat and barley cordial. Martin carried a plate across to Blade Rib. The sea rat was quite comfortable, wrapped in a cloak and a blanket. The warrior once again questioned his captive. Could that have been the vessel Wave Worm that Welko sighted earlier? Are we on the right course? The sea rat grabbed his plate of food, nodding.
Aye, that'll be her. You'll be sailing into wintry seas now. Cold and dangerous, fog and ice. If and we gets through it, you'll probably sight her again in the good weather. She'll be headed due west, toward the setting sun, like I told you.
Martin caught the sea rat's paw as he was about to eat.
Play me false just once, Blade Rib, and I'll slay you. Is that clear?
Steer us true if you want to stay alive. The sea rat shrugged.
I'm bound to die sooner or later, if not by your paw. Then it'll either be Lask Frildur or Ublah's Mad Eyes, for allowing myself to be taken captive.
32. Viola got on famously with Plog and Welko, the sons of Logalog. As night began setting over the deep, the small crew wrapped an old sailcloth around themselves and sat in a circle, with Klecki's little fire at the center to keep out the intensifying cold. The lanky hare sang a song to keep their spirits up.
Of all the creatures in the land, the sea, or in the air, not one of them is half so grand or noble as a hare. A hare can jump, a hare can run. He don't live down a hole. In fact, a hare's a lot more fun than almost any mole. A hare's courageous and so brave, good-mannered, and quite courtly. Sometimes he's serious and grave, but never fat, just portly. He never puts a footpaw wrong, his disposition's sunny, with ears so elegant and long, not stubby like a bunny. So sing his praises everywhere, this creature bold with charm to spare. The one thing better than a hare is two hares. That's a pair.
Klecki helped himself to a piece of toasted cheese.
I take a bow, but I don't want to rock the jolly old boat, what?
Grath nodded in mock admiration.
You're far too modest for words, matey.
The hare nodded agreement as he gobbled the cheese down.
Hmm. Shy and retiring, too. Though it's more a bally virtue than a fault to a chap like me, you know.
Grath snatched the last piece of cheese before Klecki could lay paw to it.
Well said, matey. You're just the shy, retiring type we've been looking for, to keep first watch. Wake me in an hour's time.
The little craft, with its outriggers, sailed through the night towards the fog bank, with Klecki's mutterings echoing faintly across the still waters.
Humph! Good job I'm polite and withdrawn, too. Not like these otter types, brash, common wallas. Still, what can one expect of a creature with funny little ears and a tail like a bally plank?
The night was pitch black and wreathed in thick, damp fog when Grath shook Martin to take third watch.
Come on, matey, time for your watch. Here's a beaker of oat and barley water I heated up on the fire. Wake Plog for his watch when you've done yours.
Martin thanked the otter and moved up into the bow of the longboat. Crouching, he snuggled into his cloak, sipping gratefully at the hot drink as he kept watch. However, it was only the damp, bitter cold that kept him awake. All that was visible, even to the keenest eye, was a solid wall of whitish-gray fog. How long he crouched there, Martin did not know. Strange shapes loomed up out of the mists, only to vaporize and vanish. Martin knew they were all from his imagination. One after another, the specters appeared before his wearying eyes. Dragons, great fish, corsair galleys. At one point, he actually thought he saw Redwall Abbey. Shaking himself and rubbing his eyes, he tried hard to stay awake and keep a sense of normality in a world of wraith-like apparitions, swirling and rolling like patterns in watery milk.
He watched as a towering mountain of ice loomed large directly in front of the longboat. Another trick his mind was playing on him, he thought, blinking furiously. Or was it?
Crunch!
Suddenly the warrior mouse was wrenched to his senses by the danger. All paws forward, Martin yelled. Freezing icy water poured into the longboat. It sizzled and hissed as it drowned Clucky's small fire. Grath grabbed Viola as she dived towards the bow to join Clucky and the two shrews. There was a tearing, rending noise, followed by an agonized scream, which was cut short in a whoosh of water. Grath scrambled back along the cracking planks of the disintegrating longboat to investigate. She was immediately back, yelling, "Overboard! Every beast abandon the boat!" Leaping over the side into the freezing water, they were amazed to find that it was no more than a thin stream. They found themselves standing paw-deep on top of solid ice. Only Grath could explain the phenomenon. "Where I come from, on the far north coast, we heard tales of this from seals and sea otters. This is a floating mountain of ice. I think they called it an iceberg. From what I can see, our craft ran into a deep crack in the shallow edge of this iceberg. It crushed both the shrewboat outriggers. We jumped overboard as it struck the longboat. Blade Rib, the sea rat, didn't stand a chance." Viola shuddered at the thought of the sea rat's fate. Crushed to death by an ice mountain. What a dreadful way to die. Grath put aside her bow and quiver, nodding grimly. "Don't feel sorrow for that, missy. His passing was quick and easy. Not like the innocent creatures he slew for no reason." "Right. What's the next move, Martin?" The warrior mouse adjusted the sword belt across his shoulders. "We'd best go and see if we can salvage anything from the wreckage. Flog and Welko, you stay here with Viola. It should be light soon. Grath, Clecky, come with me." The hare jumped from the ledge onto the water-covered ice shelf. Immediately he slipped, falling flat on his tail.
"Cha! I say, you chaps, this is all a bit much. No boat, no grub, no fire, and now a blinkin' wet behind, what?"
Grath slid across the ice, using her tail as a rudder. Reaching the edge, she called out happily, "Ahoy, there's the logboat with the supplies in it. Come and lend a paw, mates." The shrew craft was floating just a short distance from where they stood, practically undamaged. Having the longest reach of the three, Clecky took Martin's sword, and while they held him teetering on the edge of the ice floe, he leaned out and jabbed at the logboat, using the sword like a harpoon. There was a soft thunk as the sharp steel tip bit into wood. The hare drew the narrow craft slowly and carefully in. Then Grath leaned out and grabbed the stern firmly.
"Got it! What a stroke of luck! This logboat must have snapped off and shot backward into the sea instead of being crushed. Here, Martin, hold on to my tail while I pull her up onto the ice."
With a mighty heave, the powerful otter lifted the stern clear of the water and slid the logboat up onto the ice. Martin sharpened a broken spar into a pointed stake, then dug a hole in the ice with his sword point. Clecky held the stake steady as Grath drove it tightly into the hole. They made the logboat fast to the stake by its head rope, then climbed aboard to take stock of the supplies. Gradually, the grayish fog changed to soft white with the advent of dawn. The silence was total. Even the voices of the small crew sounded muffled and subdued by the heavy, all-prevailing mist curtain. Using a canvas sail, the friends had rigged a tent from forward to aft on the logboat. Now relatively snug, they sat watching Clecky. The hare had gathered wood from the wreckage, splitting it to find the driest pieces. Using a flint, he struck a spark against Martin's sword blade onto a heap of splinters and torn sacking scraps from the supply wrappings. A faint glow, accompanied by a wisp of smoke, had the hungry hare chortling happily.
"Oh, ho, ho, ho! I say, pals, never mind the dangers and flippin' perils besettin' us. Who's for a good hot scoff, what?"
Every beast in the crew contributed their cooking skills to make what for cold and famished creatures was an epic feast. Martin and Viola chopped carrots, mushrooms, and any vegetables they could find among the packs. Clecky and Grath boiled water in an iron pot, adding herbs, dried water shrimp, and hot root. Flog and Welko toasted shrew bread and warmed some damson wine. Soon they were tucking into tasty bowls of soup, followed by hot shrew bread spread with cherry preserve and small beakers of damson wine, warm from the fire. Welko patted his stomach.
"Eat up, mates. There's naught like good victuals to keep your spirits high. "Aye, make the best of it," Flog responded, a little gloomily. "There's little enough left. Over half our supplies were lost along with that sea rat in the other logboat. Dunno where the next good meal's coming from." Viola leaned across and dabbed some cherry preserve onto the pessimistic shrew's nose. "Thank you for those few cheery words, sir, you little fat misery. Aren't you glad to be alive?"
Welko tugged his brother's ear heartily.
"Come on, smile, you sulky little toad, smile!"
Flog pulled a long face, at which Martin burst out laughing. "If only your father could see you now. I vote, as captain of this craft, that if Plog doesn't start smiling and singing straight away, we toss him into the water and let him turn into an ice lump." There was a loud cry of agreement. Grath seized the shrew by his belt, winking at Klecky.
"Good idea. I ain't sitting in the same boat as a shrew with a gob on him like a flattened ferret."
Immediately Plog grinned from ear to ear and broke into song.
"Oh, I'm happy as the day is long, I'm cheery, merry, bright, from early morn I sings me song, until last thing at night. Chop off me paws, slice off me tail, and my poor neck start ringin'. You'll never hear me cry or wail, because I'll still be singin'. Ooh, flug-a-dug-a-dug-a-chug-chug-chug, with a smile like a duck upon me mug."
Flog's song was greeted by laughter and cheers, merriment that would have soon ceased, had the friends known that keen dark eyes, scores of them, were watching through the mists, as heavy damp forms slid wet and silent towards the little logboat lying on the broad watery ice ledge. 33. Powder blue and cloudless, the morning sky hung hot and still over Redwall Abbey. Dewdrops evaporating from leaf and grass left orchard and lawn a soft summer green. Trilling birdsong resounded from mossflower wood beyond the ancient sandstone walls. Summer was blossoming into long hot days and still warm evenings. Hogwife Teasel sat at breakfast between Alma and Tansy. She rapped the table impatiently with her ladle, glancing from one to the other as she remonstrated with them.
"Sittin' here a-frettin' ain't doing you a smidge of good. I tell you, Alma, those three Dibbons will show up when they've a mind to, and those others will soon find Viola. We can be sure of that. And as for you, Missy Tansy, great seasons, just look at yourself, a mopin' and a floppin' about like a fish on a bank. What help is that to any beast? Now you listen to me, friends. This abbey'll be searched from attic to orchard today, and those three babes will be found, and that's an end to it. Now I need some beast to lend a paw sortin' through the fruit and veggies from the spring crop. Seein' as I don't have Abbot Durrell to help me, I'll need you, Mother Alma. Tansy, take your little friends and old Rollo and get searchin'. Land sakes, we may need those pearls to get our abbot back. Leave the Dibbon searchin' to Brother Dormall, Skipper, and Sister Cicely. They've got every abbey beast organized for a day-long Dibbon hunt."
The badger pushed away her half-empty platter and gave a huge sigh. Smiling, she patted Teasel's work-worn paw.
"Right. Lead me to those fruit and vegetables. Tansy, you heard our good hogwife. Back to your search, miss."
Picknam, Cracklin, and Rollo were trying to pry Garrel loose from the breakfast table. The greedy owl was hurriedly stuffing the last of a batch of bilberry scones into his beak and washing them down with cold mint tea.
"Arnell! Don't be rushing me, you dreadful creatures, or I'll get indigestions, and me old stomach, and I won't be able to think."
Tansy folded the scones into a serviette and gave them to him.
"Here, famine beak, take these with you. Whoever heard of an owl thinking with his stomach?"
Garrel hopped ahead of them to the attics, still protesting.
"Any sensible owl thinks with his stomach. Shows how much you know, Miss Spikehead. Me old mother always used to say to me that my head was so full of nonsense that I'd have to think with me stomach, and that way, if I fell on me head, I wouldn't hurt me brain. So you see, I've got to have plenty of packin' round me stomach to protect it, in case I need to do some serious thinkin'."
When they reached Fermall's attic, Garrel took the house martin's empty nest and placed a glittering fragment of crystal in it.
"Here now, Cracklin, you're young and spry. Attach this nest to the fishing rod, and place it back down on that ledge where you found it, to return and steal the piece of crystal. Then we follow it,
Good idea. Geralt perched on the armchair and unwrapped his scones.
I'm not just feathers and a beak, you know. Us owls are supposed to be very wise. Now, Tansy, you take Picknum and Cracklin, stay below on the south wall top, and watch the nest from there. When you see the old jackdaw, they'll have to move sharp-like to keep up with him. 'Cause you don't want to lose the bird, do you? Now, hurry along, young missus. Me and Rollo will watch from up here.
About mid-morning, Friar Higgle's stump came waddling along the wall-top with a laden sack upon his back. He stopped by the three abbey maids and nodded to them.
Good day to you, missus. Ain't you joining the search for those missing dibbins?
Still staring up at the nest on the high ledge of the abbey building, Picknum shook her head.
Oh, good day, Friar. No, we're not searching.
Higgle set the heavy sack down.
Hum, I see. So what are you doing, pray tell? Watching our abbey to see if it grows any taller?
Without taking her eyes from the nest, Tansy replied,
No, we're just watching that house martin's nest, Friar.
Higgle nodded understandingly.
Oh, I see. Good hobby, nest watching. Perhaps you'd like to shell these chestnuts. They're good and dry enough for shelling right now.
Cracklin looked at the Friar, taking her eyes from the nest momentarily.
Titch, do we have to? She said.
Higgle nodded, smiling affably at the squirrel maid.
I'm afraid you do, miss. That's if you want strawberry flan and meadow cream for lunch. No work, no food. Can't have idle paws round Redwall. And chestnuts don't shell themselves, you know.
Automatically the three friends began shelling nuts, still gazing upward at the nest as they talked.
"'Tain't fair. We're already doing one job, watching the nest.
Now we're doing two jobs, watching and shelling. Maybe if we waggled our tails a bit, we could sweep the wall top. Then we'd be doing three jobs.
Aye, and who knows, if we started singing a song together, that'd keep those down below happy, and that'd be four jobs we'd be doing.
But just think, if Sister Cicely saw us, watching the nest, shelling nuts, sweeping the wall top with our tails, and singing, you know what would happen, don't you?
Yes, she'd think there was something dreadfully wrong with us, and she'd put us to bed in sick bay and feed us warm nettle broth.
Grooch! Let's just stick to two jobs.
Rising to its noontide zenith, the high summer sun shone down on the three abbey maids sitting on the wall top. The same sun also shone on three tiny dibbins, trundling far in the depths of Mossflower. Not surprisingly, they had stayed awake half the night, wrapping themselves in the blanket they intended making into a tent. They had kept up their courage by eating all their supplies 3 hours before dawn. Now they staggered on, paw sore and weary, completely lost and dispirited. Arvin, the leader, was the only one of the trio who had been outside in the woods before. The other two followed him, complaining.
"'Your Harvin, do he knows where you'm a taken us'ns?' "'Course a knows. We go into de abbey. It not far now.' "'Grr, you'm said dat when he dawn breaked. We'm still wanderin' round, though. I'm a-thinkin' us'ns be losted.'
Arvin took a swipe at a tall nettle with his stick.
"'Losted? Don't be silly. I don't get losted. But I orful hungry. You'm scoffed all our cake, dig'em greedy tummy.'
Gerbil sat down, curling into a ball on the woodland floor.
"'Hoo-aw! I be terrible sleepery.'
Diggum joined him, covering her snout with her apron.
"'And I, too. May I be little rest do as I good.'
Arvin sat down by the two mole babes, brandishing his stick.
"'Ah! You two bees only infants. I stay wake and keep guards.'
A short time later, all three were curled on the ground, snoring uproariously in the windless, sun-warmed woodlands. Without knowing, Arvin had led them north and in a curve to the west, and now they were not far from the main path leading to Redwall. Somewhere nearby, a song thrush trilled melodiously, his music mingling with that of a descending skylark out on the open flatlands, where grasshoppers chirruped endlessly in a dry chorus. But none of this disturbed the deep slumbers of the exhausted Dibbons. They slept on, snouts twitching and paws quivering occasionally, as they dreamed small dreams. 34. Gerald had placed the crystal so that it could be seen through the nest opening. Late noon sunlight glinted off the fragment, sending out pale green and soft golden facets of twinkling light. Scroovo, the jackdaw, saw it immediately. Ever on the alert for bright objects, the bird had been ranging far and wide, after taking a midday repast of grubs and woodlice from a rotting log he had found in a woodland clearing. Scroovo wheeled in midair, his needle-sharp eyes watching the iridescence of the crystal shard as he performed a neat loop in his flight west. Soaring gracefully downward, he spread dark-feathered wings wide and stuck his talons forward, beating the air back as he landed on the ledge. He cocked his head to one side, squinting with one eye at the treasure. Bright, shiny, twinkling. He hopped towards it and gave a harsh cry of delight. Chock! Kia! He struck the crystal with his beak point, as if attacking a living thing. It did not move or fight back, so he struck it several more times to assure himself it was harmless. Quite satisfied, the jackdaw did a curious hop-skip shuffle, his victory dance. Then he plucked the piece of crystal from the nest and flung himself from the ledge. Down he spiraled crazily, like a dark-torn scrap of cloth buffeted by breezes. Then, leveling out, he winged strongly upward and shot off southeast into Mossflower. Leaping to their paws, the three Abbey maids scampered down the wall stairs, stumbling in their haste, calling, "It's the jackdaw! There it goes!" Gerald and Rollo descended the stairs as fast as they could, making haste out to the lawn. They arrived in time to see the three friends slipping out of Redwall by the small south wicker gate in the outer wall. The owl looked sadly at his damaged wing. "Faith, 'tisn't the walkin' I mind, but I do wish I could fly again." Rollo shaded his eyes with both paws, peering up into the blue. "I fear they'll have lost that jackdaw by now. It would be far too difficult to follow a bird through woodlands." The old recorder's fears proved true. Tansy and her friends were far too small to keep track of a high-flying jackdaw, but they were not about to admit defeat. Cracklin went scooting up a nearby sycamore with all the agility of a young squirrel maid. Picknum and Tansy almost lost sight of her, until she emerged swaying among the topmost branches. She watched a while, then pointed eagerly before scrambling down. Back on the ground, breathless and disheveled, she shouted, "Circling south! The jackdaw's taking a round sweep southward!" Tansy grinned and clapped her paws. "Of course! It's headed to old Ninian's church! Come on!" As they dashed by the southwest corner of the abbey, the maids bumped into Gerald and Rollo, who had exited Redwall by its main gate. Rollo was agog for information. "Did you see the bird? Which way did it go?" Tansy nodded. "To the old church, I think." Dust rose in a small column as the three abbey maids hurtled off down the path, Rollo and Garrow following them at a more sedate pace. The old recorder explained to the owl about the ancient building. "No beast really knows when Ninian's was built, or who built it. Every once in a while creatures will try to settle there, but it's so damp and decaying they leave after a short time. It would be an ideal dwelling for scavengers like jackdaws." Gerald hobbled along the dusty path as swiftly as he could, leaving Rollo behind. "Sure, if there's more than one jackdaw to deal with, those young maids will be in trouble," he shouted as he went. "Those are bad and dangerous birds, if they're disturbed. I'll try to catch up with them." Twilight's first shadows were stealing gently over the woodlands, when a long javelin sank deep into the ground next to the sleeping Dibbons. Arvin was wakened by a huge dark shape, which swept him up into its powerful paws.
"Yeek! It's a blizzard's! They got me! Help!" he yelled.
Still befuddled by slumber, Diggum and Gerbil found themselves hefted upward in similar fashion.
"Hooer! Let I go, zur! We'm not but babes! E blizzard's going to eat us all oop! Oh, woe!"
the mole babes cried out. Chuckling deeply, Rangapaw, daughter of Skipper, held the kicking, struggling Arvin firmly.
"Belay there, you little maggots!
We ain't going to eat you. Quit wriggling, or you'll fall on your head.
Diggum scrambled up onto the shoulder of the otter who was holding her. Grabbing his whiskers, she stared into her rescuer's eyes and said,
You'm bait no blizzard. You'm a hotter.
Rangapaw tucked Arvin firmly into her side as she retrieved her javelin.
Ho, ho, matey. Lucky for you, we are. Now what are you three rogues doing a-wandering off from your abbey? Can't you see 'tis close on nightfall? And we're supposed to be searching for a vole maid, not blizzard hunters.
Arvin popped out of his captor's grasp. Landing nimbly on the ground, he folded his paws across his small fat stomach and murmured darkly,
Us was huntin' for blizzards who took Farver Habit and Voler. Us was gonna catcher 'em and get all mucky and scratchered and bring 'em back to the habby and not get shouted at.
The big otter shook with silent laughter at the three dibbins. She could understand their predicament, having had many similar adventures when she was small.
You did well, mates, she said. We saw a great crowd of them blizzards just a short time ago. They was running for their cowardly lives, 'cause they knew three warriors like you was abroad tracking 'em. Ain't that right, mates?
The otter crew caught her broad wink and nodded solemnly.
Oh, aye, running scared stiff they was. Har, I wouldn't have liked to be one of them if you'd three caught up with 'em.
Save us from those bloodthirsty dibbins, they was crying.
I heard 'em with me own two ears.
Arvin scowled ferociously, picking up his stick and shaking it.
Come on, you can help us. We soon catch 'em.
Rangapaw swept the tiny squirrel up onto her shoulder.
Nah, leave 'em, mate. They ain't worth it. We got to get you roughnecks back to Redwall. Ahoy, Rushcutter! Break out some supplies so these warriors can eat on the way back.
Gerbil prodded the otter in question.
Hurry, and hurry ye up. Oi be girtly ungered.
Back at the abbey, Higgle Stump checked the contents of his ovens for the third time that evening.
What'll I do, Teasel? Serve the meal, or empty these ovens and let the victuals cool before they get spoiled?
Goodwife Teasel continued ladling cooked gooseberry and rhubarb into a bowl. She was making a crumble.
Can't serve food if and they're all still out searching. Wait till I finish this, then I'll go and find Mother Alma, see what she wants us to do with all this good fare.
Alma was sitting on the abbey doorstep with Skipper, scratching her muzzle worriedly.
We should have started searching for those little ones last night, she said. Sister Cicely wanted to, and I stopped her.
Leave them, I said. They'll come out of hiding when they're hungry enough. Now look, we've searched all day long, every beast in the abbey, and still not a trace of them. It's all my fault, Skipper. And there's poor Viola, too, out there in the woods alone, lost or captured, or worse.
The tough otter laid a gentle paw on his friend's shoulder.
Don't you go blaming yourself, Marm.
I'd have said the same, knowing those three little snips.
Hearken, what's that?
Bong, boom, boom-a-bong.
Furlough Stump's shouts rang out from the bell tower between the peals of Redwall's twin bells.
Otter crew coming down the path with three dibbins. I see 'em clear. Open the gates, Wolger.
The big badger mother of Redwall swept away a tear with her apron corner as she hurried to the main gate.
Praise the fates, they're safe. But what of Viola?
Sister Cicely caught up with her.
There's no sign, but at least these three are alive. Seasons be thanked.
Outside the abbey walls, if you please, wandering all over Mossflower without a care in the world, I'll be bound.
Well, just wait until I have a word with those three. I'll wager it was that little ragtag Arvin who kept them out in those woods.
A single bell tolled four times, calling all Redwallers to the meal in Great Hall. Owing to the addition of Logalog and his Gwasom Shrews, who had stayed to help with the search, and Rangapaw's otter crew, extra tables had been laid. Alma approached Rangapaw anxiously.
"Was there no sign of our little vole maid?" she asked. "I can't bear to think of her lost and alone out in those dark woods."
"Sorry, Marm," replied Rangapaw,
"but rest assured, as soon as we've dealt with these three little ones, we'll resume our search."
Sister Cicely and several of the other Abbey elders were of the opinion that the three Dibbons should be sent straight to bed after a good dressing down for all the trouble they had caused. However, it was not to be. Skipper's daughter Rangipaw defended the babe stoutly, winning Alma and many others to her side. The otter went into comical detail, relating the attitude of Arvin and the two moles, and soon had every beast nodding and smiling. Finally, she seated the trio among her otters.
"Mates, I can't think of no better tribute to these three warriors who saved this old abbey from being overrun by blizzards than being made official members of my otter crew. We need brave beasts like Arvin, Diggum, and Gerbil to protect us in our old age, when they're growed and we're staggering about all gray-furred."
Before Sister Cicely could protest, Logalog stood up, saying,
"I second that. No sense in breaking their spirits by shouting at 'em and sending 'em off to bed with no victuals. They're three good uns. What do you say, Skip?"
The otter chieftain stroked his whiskers thoughtfully.
"Well, if you put it that ways, matey, what can I say? We could have all been slayed or taken prisoner by blizzards, whatever they be. But for these three, I'll say this, though. If they're to be otter crew, then they got to abide by our laws."
Here Rangipaw turned to the three Dibbons and stopped them stuffing their faces with strawberry junket for a moment.
"You three take an oath by fur, fire, and water that you don't go wandering off again, unless it's with my permission? Also, do you swear that you'll act like proper otter crew warriors, obeying the orders of your elders, never telling fibs, being good to all beasts, and growing up well-mannered? Do you take the oath?"
Diggum stood up on her chair, waving a spoon.
"Ho, aye, zir, us'uns take ye oaths."
There was general cheering and laughter as the three Dibbons stood nobly, paws on stomachs, because they were not sure where their hearts were located. Even Sister Cicely managed to smile. Rangipaw called her scouts together and spoke gravely to Alma, before silently slipping away to resume the search for Viola.
"Don't you fret, Marm. We won't rest night or day until we've searched every tree, nook, and hollow of Mossflower Woods and found the little maid."
The merriment ceased abruptly when the abbey door banged open wide, and Wolger the gatekeeper staggered in, holding up Tansy and Cracklin. They made it to the front of the main table, then collapsed on the floor, breathless and sobbing. Wolger looked pleadingly at Alma.
"I can't get no sense out of them, Marm, but I think something terrible's happened down at old Ninian's church."
Alma was around the table surprisingly quickly, for one of her long seasons and great girth. The big badger bathed the abbey maid's tear-stained faces with cold water from a bowl. Skipper and Logalog kept back the press of anxious Redwallers who had left their seats to crowd around the two exhausted creatures. Goodwife Teasel assisted, bathing Tansy's brow and calming her until she had recovered enough to speak coherently. Teasel leaned close to the hedgehog maid, stroking her cheek, and said,
"Easy now, little un. Take your time. You're among friends."
Tansy's voice was racked by sobs, and great tears coursed down her face as she explained breathlessly.
"Ran all the way here. Attacked by jackdaws. Indians. Rollo hiding. In ditch. Geralt said get help. Picknum. Oh, no. Oh, Picknum."
Alma was nursing Cracklin. She heard what Tansy said as if from afar. The badger clasped the squirrel maid's face between her paws and asked,
"Is this true?"
Cracklin nodded, her head falling forward in exhaustion. The badger mother looked at her paws, blood-stained from the deep scratches on the squirrel maid's face. Logalog drew his rapier, his paws trembling with rage as he turned to Skipper.
"Fetch back your daughter and her crew.
Wassum, arm yourselves. We've got business to attend to double quick. Come on."
35. The Emperor Ublaz Mad-Eyes rose in a thunderous mood. He had been awakened by timid tapping on his bedchamber door.
"If you must knock, then knock. Don't stand around there all day tipping and tapping. Get in here."
Chief Trident Rat Sagatar gingerly stepped into the bedchamber. A shaft of early morning sunlight cut across the rumpled silk sheets onto the face of the pine marten. Ublaz shaded his eyes with a paw, blinking irately at the hapless rat.
"What is it now? Speak up!"
Sagittar took a deep breath before launching into her report. "Sire, one of your monitors was washed up on the tide line this morning at dawn. He was lashed to a rudder and tiller, slain." This was stuffed in his mouth, sire. Ublaz snatched the damp scrap of sailcloth from the rat's nervous paws, unrolled it swiftly, and sat staring at the message written in the blood of the monitor. "Death to Mad Eyes from Rasconza and the Wave Brethren." Flinging the sailcloth from him, he ran to the window and glared out at the hot tropic seas, peaceful and quiet in the early morn. "That makes 4 altogether in 2 days, all monitors. Tell me, have the wave scum returned to the taverns?" Sagittar shook her head decisively. "No, sire, nor have they sought to board their ships. The whole harbor area lies deserted. The corsairs and sea rats have taken to the hills." Ublaz pushed the trident rat aside with a snarl. "I know that, blockhead. They have food, supplies, and arms that they took with them."
"Could we not hunt them down, sire?"
Sagittar suggested helpfully. Ublaz whirled on her, his temper rising.
"No, we could not. They are only waiting for me to leave this palace unguarded, and they will be in here immediately. Go away, marshal all your trident rats and the remainder of my monitors, place guards around the whole area, and keep me informed of any movements out there. Leave me now. I must think."
Bukla, the sea rat captain, Guja, the steers rat, and Grujaw, the stoat captain, had captured another monitor. They had the lizard bound and gagged. He tottered ahead of them as they prodded him forward with stolen tridents. Rasconza sat roasting a lobster over the embers of a campfire at the northwestern inlet of San Petra. He nodded affably at the trio as they hurled the lizard to the sand.
"Ha-ha! Another prisoner, eh, mates? What's happening down at our great emperor's palace?"
Buckler squatted in the shade of a rock, away from the sun's fierce heat, and took a swallow from a jug of seaweed grog.
"Ah, that's better. Ain't get much cooler, is it? Old Mad Eyes is forted up in his palace, afraid to move out. We delivered the last monitor, like you said, loaded him in all pretty-like.
Sagittar took your message up to Ublaz.
We caught this in guarding the ships on the jetty."
End of Side 5. To continue, turn the cassette over.